We're talking about a lawsuit over frac sand mines here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dozens of property owners in the western part of the state are suing two frac sand mines that they claim are inundating their homes with dust, polluting their wells, and driving down property values. How are you being impacted by frac sand mining near you? What are you seeing? We're at 800-642-1234. Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back.
Morning, Kate.
Well, an attorney representing these landowners in Trempealeau County say this is the first time landowners have ever sued a frac sand facility by calling their operations a nuisance. So how is this suit defining a nuisance?
Basically, it's saying that these operations the attorney literally said that these operations are making these people's lives a living hell. They're saying that it's a nuisance because property values are being impacted negatively. Also, the claim is that, you know, these people's health are in danger because of this dust. Well water has become, some of the property owners have reported well water that's become cloudy with sediment, and they feel that that's probably due to blasting and vibrations caused at the mines. And some of these mines are within a quarter mile of these people's homes. So light pollution, noise pollution, the list goes on and on.
And these landowners have then argued that these mines have also caused their property values to go down. How can they prove that, or what do we see there?
Well, The proving that part has been difficult. There's been some press reports out there that try to get at that, but it's kind of a chicken versus the egg situation. But these people say that they can't, in effect, they can't move because no one will want to buy their properties because their properties are right up against an industrial facility. So that's their claim.
How did these mines rise up next to their homes in the first place?
So when these companies came into Wisconsin, I'd say that most of the build-out of the Wisconsin frac sand mining industry happened between 2010 and 2015. So what they would do, the companies would generally go to, they went to where the sand was, and that the deposits happened to be in western Wisconsin, Trempealeau County, Chippewa County, Barron County, those are areas where the sandstone that the companies want to mine, it's very close to the surface. So they were kind of attracted to certain geographies. And then they go to town boards and say, we would like to build this facility. And through that whole drawn-out process, you know, they may get a permit to mine from the township. But in Trempealeau County specifically, there's an interesting twist. These mines were under county rules when they were operating in townships. Those county rules were a little bit stifling, according to the mines, because they limited when they could operate. They couldn't go 24/7. The mine company said they need to go 24/7, so they went to nearby cities and encouraged them to annex their properties. So while these mines popped up and are still located technically in these townships, the annexation makes them properties of the cities of Whitehall and Blair.
And so that's what we know about the high crush situation in Whitehall and Blair, where this annexation occurred.
Yeah. There was multiple annexations in Trempealeau County, and that's created a lot of headaches for local governments because when you're the city is basically stretching its boundaries along a narrow strip and then around a sand mine. So for landowners, it was a headache because, you know, if they are upset with what's going on at the mine, they used to be able to call the county. They used to be able to call their town board chair. Now they can't call the city because these residents are not citizens of the city, and they can't vote for the people that make decisions regarding the sand mine. So that's one issue. And then just something as simple as plowing has become an issue because you'll have one small stretch of a road that's technically city property, and then the townships and the county and the city have to negotiate who plows that and who gets paid for that.
We're talking about a couple frac sand mining companies in Trempealeau County. They're being sued by 40 Wisconsin landowners. Rich Kramer is following this. He is WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live near a frac sand mine? What is it like? Are you an attorney? Have you worked on environmental lawsuits like this? How does the process work? Is there a strong case? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Rich, what are the 40 landowners in Trempealeau County wanting to accomplish through filing multiple lawsuits against the company Hi-Crush?
Well, I think they want to achieve a few different things. You know, first, they want to draw attention to the issue. This is an issue that landowners living around sand mines have complained about and tried to raise concerns about for a long time. Just the fact that these operations, from their point of view, are very disturbing, like to live next to, and it disturbs the environment, etc. But also, they're seeking financial compensation, basically cash remedies. And part of that is because some of the landowners say they cannot afford to move because they won't be able to get anyone to buy their properties. So the idea is that they would use some money from the settlement to relocate. But also, within the documents, the lawsuits, they're seeking Hi-Crush to pay into a fund that would potentially be available to people that might have health issues as a result, would pay medical costs and whatnot.
Let's go to Ben in Madison now. Ben, hi.
Good morning. So I'm curious if we could follow the money here. Who wins when these mines go in? Who's getting paid off, or what money is flowing from one group to another, that anyone would even consider allowing such a messy operation a quarter mile from residences?
Ben, thanks for the call. And Rich, you know quite a bit about the frac sand industry and its highs and lows in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of money involved, even when times are bad. Right now, the market's kind of low in Wisconsin in terms of demand for Wisconsin sand, but when these companies were coming to town, the price of oil per barrel was very high. Sand companies were making a lot of money. And at the time, Wisconsin sand was considered the best in the nation. So these companies would come in with regards to these annexations. Sometimes they would offer townships and cities one-time financial payments. They offered them royalties per ton, you know, maybe 50 cents a ton or something like that. I mean, it worked out to hundreds of thousands, if not more than $1 million for each of these small cities and town. You know, it's a lot of money. I mean, it's a huge amount of money for these local governments. And then the whole thing has been, and also the whole argument about the jobs. These rural areas don't have a lot of jobs. People are kind of leaving the area. So the argument was that these companies would provide a place to kind of give people, you know, good-paying work.
Rich, we're about out of time, but very quickly, where are the lawsuits right now? What is the timeline?
Oh, it's so early in the process. Basically, the lawsuits were served to Hi-Crush and its subsidiaries that owns the mines. So now there's like 45-day period where Hi-Crush has to officially respond. And then there's the discovery process. This thing is going to take years.
Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. We've been talking about Hi-Crush's frac sand mines in Trempealeau County that are being challenged in lawsuits by dozens of landowners. Up next, as wedding season ramps up, we learn about how couples balance tradition with changing gender norms. That conversation is coming up next here on the Ideas Network. we are talking about wedding traditions that people have come to expect. What's changing? What's not? As they walk down the aisle, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than two-thirds of U.S. couples still seek a parent blessing before tying the knot. As for bridal attire, those in the Americas and Europe continue to embrace white dresses. These are insights from a new report by the bridal site The Knot and WeddingWire.com based on a survey of about 20,000 newlyweds in 14 countries. Have you attended a wedding recently? Did some rituals seem dated or out of place? What about today's weddings no longer feel relevant? We're at 800-642-1234 and you can join in. Lindsay Bernhagen is director of the Center for Inclusive Teaching and Learning at the UW Stevens Point. She teaches sociology, gender, sexuality, and women's studies. Lindsay, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with wedding vows. When we look at traditional wedding vows, there is that word in there, obey your spouse. It doesn't feel very modern these days, you know, particularly as we look at trying to achieve equal partnership. What do we know about vows and how they've held the test of time?
So I think that the word obey, well, first of all, it's something that only the woman says. It's not something that the man says when we're talking about heterosexual marriages. And that really comes from the 16th century, the Book of Common Prayer, which is where the standard vows come from. And just to give a little bit of background on it, yes, there are definitely some deeply gendered undertones to that word. But what she was doing is she was promising to obey her husband. And because she couldn't own property back then, because women didn't have any property rights, he was then, as a compliment to that, promising her that she would have sort of access to all of his property. So that was the equivalent. Although it's still pretty, it's unsettling to hear it, I think, in the 21st century.
Oh, so almost like doing you a favor, right? Like you're going to be part of this too. You're my partner here.
Yeah, like I'll obey you if you share all your stuff with me. Like that's the trade-off. But I think part of the man's verbiage that sort of made that equivalency in the original vows started to fall away, but the obey part stuck around for a long time. Fortunately, I don't hear it too much at weddings anymore. But I do on occasion. I do on occasion. It still sticks around.
There's also the promise to have your partner in sickness and in health as long as you both shall live. That doesn't always end up being the case. Lots of divorce. Are people setting themselves up to fail when they make promises that are these traditions that date back to the 1500s, words that may not be relevant today?
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, there are a lot of ways to think about that. I'm very lucky in that I come from a long line of people who were married for a long time. My grandparents were married for, I think, about 60 years before my grandfather passed away on one side and about the same amount of time on the other side. My parents were married for about 40 years before my dad passed away. So I do believe that's a possibility, but we, I think, need to remember that our sort of ideals for marriage, first of all, were based on not really the love contract that we see today or the idea that it's about love. And secondly, they were created at a time when people's lifespans were much, much shorter than they are now. So to promise to love somebody for the rest of their life, you know, in the 16th, or to be with somebody, to be faithful to them for the rest of their lives in the 16th century, maybe meant, you know, 20 or 30 years. It didn't mean 40, 60, 70 years like we see now.
And when you look at the traditions of wedding vows, these are recited by each, you know, the wife or the husband and the wife. And so, you know, they're not read by someone else. They first are, but then they're recited back. What does that tradition have on the impact of these customs?
The reciting back part?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it says that there's another authority that's sort of giving you that's recognizing your relationship. And I know that there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with that. I mean, a lot of couples who've decided not to get married because they're uncomfortable with that idea that their relationship is only valid if some other authority, especially if we're talking about a priest or, you know, a pastor or something, recognizes it. And that's uncomfortable. It says something about whether or not we believe that this relationship is valid, whether or not the people who are participating in it really have ultimate agency over their own relationship. So that there's definitely some history there that I think makes a lot of people uncomfortable. or, you know, people who decide not to get legally married for that reason, too. They don't think that the state should necessarily be deciding that some relationships are more valid than other relationships.
We're talking with Lindsay Bernhagen. She's director of the Center for Inclusive Teaching and Learning at the UW-Stevens Point. And we're looking at the customs in wedding ceremonies. And she teaches sociology, gender, sexuality, and women's studies. You can join in 800-642-1234. Have you been to a wedding recently? What customs did you see in the ceremony? Did you try something unconventional for your own wedding? How was that received by family and friends? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Lindsay, let's look at the tradition of engagement rings. How did that start and get folded into the process of getting married?
So the idea of engagement rings was really for a husband to say, or a potential spouse to say, you know, I now own you. I'm going to betroth your daughter. So it was a sort of an investment, and it was a sign to the family that he was serious. But though that's still stuck around. The idea that engagement rings should be should have diamonds in them. That's a relatively modern concept. So De Beers, the famous diamond mining company, and I think a lot of people know this history, realized that they had basically a surplus of diamonds, and they weren't really sure what to do about that. They were not of very high value, so they decided to start this campaign, A Diamond is Forever, which I think a lot of people are mm-hmm. pretty familiar with, which is basically to say that, you know, diamonds, to promise that a diamond will last the test of time like your wedding will, and to sort of create that association. So that's a relatively new phenomenon, the diamond engagement ring, the giant diamond engagement ring.
Right, and Tiffany certainly jumped on that bandwagon as well.
Oh, sure, everyone did. It's very lucrative.
Well, several wedding planning bands compiled the first ever global wedding report that came out earlier this month, looking at differences among couples around the world. And it found that in the U.S., the person doing the proposing often consulted with their partner's parents prior to popping the question. And in Europe, most parents hear about it after the fact. What do you make of this difference?
I do think that Europeans, well, I'm painting with a pretty broad brush here, but in general, especially Western Europeans, have a little bit more, let's say a less puritanical idea about relationships and about love. Things like, you know, having affairs and stuff. It's just a little bit more common. It's not quite the devastation to the relationship that it can be in the United States. So I think we do still have some very conservative or very classical, traditional ideas about what it means to get married and what the role of the parents are. I've actually been really surprised. I'm in my mid-30s, and I've been really surprised at the number of friends that I have who I consider pretty forward-thinking and pretty creative and not super traditional, who have done that themselves, who have asked their partner's parents for their future spouse's hand in marriage. It's been a little bit surprising that that's still a really persistent tradition. I do think it's out of respect for the family, which I, you know, that's a good thing, I suppose, respecting another person's family.
Lindsay, is it problematic that we view a long marriage as a success and a divorce or being single as a failure in our culture? Are those views in any way tied to how we view and celebrate weddings and commitment?
Oh, absolutely. I think that just to assume that a long marriage is a success makes a lot of assumptions about what actually is happening within that marriage. I mean, I think there are a lot of long marriages that are deeply troubled, that are very uncomfortable, damaging, hurtful for the people who are in them. That can be really hurtful for kids who are raised perhaps in a household where the parents decide to stay married, quote unquote, for the sake of the kids, but are fighting all the time, don't get along, you know, sort of model a really toxic relationship. But part of what happens with weddings is that we invest so much money in them. I mean, the average cost of a wedding these days is something like $38,000. And that's, you know, that represents a really wide span, because there are those multi-million dollar weddings, and they're the ones that cost, you know, whatever a marriage license costs. But we invest so much in it, and it's kind of hard to give up on a marriage when you've done that in front of everybody. You've made those vows. Everybody has been there to witness it. It's a little bit embarrassing. And it's maybe a little bit humiliating. So I do think sometimes people stick it out longer than they otherwise would because they invested in the wedding part of the marriage.
Go ahead.
I also think it's a mistake that a lot of folks make, that the marriage or the wedding is the happiest day of a person's life. This is a phrase that's always kind of bothered me personally, because it's like, well, does that mean that every subsequent day of your marriage is less happy than the day that you got married? And that's a little worrying. I don't know that you want to peak on day one.
We are looking at how wedding traditions have changed and emerged over the years with Lindsay Bernhagen as our guide. She's director of the Center for Inclusive Teaching and Learning at UW-Stevens Point. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Did you buck traditional wedding trends? What did you do differently? Did you get into conflicts with friends and family members about the choices you made? Perhaps you planned a more traditional wedding. What was that like? Join in, call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll continue our conversation about the traditions and gender roles that persist in modern wedding culture after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. The first ever global wedding report came out this month, and we're looking at what traditions have stood the test of time, how U.S. brides are breaking long-held customs. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The report from The Knot highlights how couples worldwide celebrate love proposals and weddings. It found that popping the question takes on different meanings around the globe. While more than 80% of couples in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada report having one partner ask the other for their hand in marriage, other countries report not taking part in that practice. Do you think wedding traditions conflict with cultural norms? Do you think the wedding industry perpetuates traditions? Are you a member of the LGBTQ community? Do you feel pressure to have a traditional wedding to please family and friends? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lindsay Bernhagen is director of the Center for Inclusive Teaching and Learning at the UW-Stevens Point, and she stays with us for this conversation. Lindsay, let's look at the communication that couples give to their guests. Wedding invites, they come in the mail. Traditionally, you address the envelope with Mr. and Mrs., husband's first and last name. Are we seeing any changes there?
We're starting to, just out of necessity, I think, because there are a lot of couples who aren't Mr. and Mrs. anymore. I do have a good friend who got married a couple of years ago, and this was about 10 years ago now. And she was sort of, I don't want to say she was in a panic, because she's not a panicky person, but she called me and she was like, I don't know how to address all of these invitations to like my same-sex couple friends, to couples who aren't married. It's very confusing because it's always, you know, to Mr. and Mrs. Smith or whatever it is, or even Mr. and Mrs. John Smith, or sort of subsuming the wife under the husband. And fortunately, there are some new guidelines that have been developed for how to do that. One of the ones that I found particularly charming as somebody who has a PhD is that if it's a heterosexual couple and the wife has a doctorate, the envelope should be addressed to, you know, Dr. Bernhagen and Mr. Bernhagen or Mr. whatever it is. So actually she comes first when she has the doctorate, which I thought was kind of amusing.
That's interesting. That would probably hold true if they're an MD as well.
Absolutely. Yep. Or if they're both doctors, then I guess he probably would traditionally still come first.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. Let's go to Felicia in Pewaukee. Hi, Felicia.
Hi, good morning. I was calling just because a comment, not everybody does the big weddings and the big white dresses. Me and my husband opted out. We just went, we had a couple best friends over, his brother, and we went to a family pastor's house, and then we didn't even get diamond rings or anything. We just have matching bands, which took forever to find, but it's so simple, so it's just easier so we don't waste all that money, and then it's just more like a competition between people. We just wanted our wedding to be simple, and it's all about our love, and then every day is a blessing.
Felicia, did that work out for you? Any regrets there on not doing it differently than that?
No, actually not, because we found that not doing it that way, we obviously saved a lot of money, but also on top of it, it was just about celebrating us, And we celebrate us all the time. Like, me and my husband, as long as, like, our bands, that's all that matters. Like, that was the most important thing. Not me having the wedding, like, diamond because they're worthless to me. But just having, a matching band was the most important thing because it just shows that we're unified. And like I said, that you don't have that nowadays. If you go to a diamond or a jeweler, you don't have matching bands anymore. They don't offer that.
Felicia, thanks so much for the call. Lindsay, what do you make of that, the matching bands and what couples do to decide what they wear on their ring finger?
Well, I love that idea, actually being thoughtful and conscientious about it. I've definitely seen a more pronounced movement toward making decisions that are more meaningful. I've got a number of friends actually who are a little bit younger now, who are in their 20s, and a lot of the husbands have actually had like their grandfather's wedding rings, or my brother, for example, had my father's wedding ring sort of soldered onto the inside of his wedding ring. So doing things like that where the ring is becoming more meaningful, I do think there's been a lot of talk about millennials and Gen Y kids, I guess I'll say, about my own people. They are sort of rejecting some of those more materialistic traditions. So even things like passing down antique furniture throughout the family. I think the New York Times had a piece about that not too long ago. They don't want the giant furniture. They don't want to spend as much money on those material possessions because, well, A, money's in shorter supply because of the wealth gap, and also because of the student loans that we all carry, something we all have in common. But also just sort of a move away from just having things for the sake of having them more generally. That's not exhaustive. That's not true of everyone, but I have definitely seen some movement away from that. And recognition that, you know, you could spend, what is it, 2 to 3 months salary on an engagement ring for your fiance, or you could buy like a car or go on vacation somewhere or save for a house, or
there are trade-offs.
Yeah. I actually have a good friend who a few years ago, this is about 10 years ago, also 15 years ago, she was in the process of planning a wedding. I was supposed to be the maid of honor. I was going to be here in Stevens Point. And she started seeing getting the catering bill and all that kind of stuff and doing the estimates. And she just said to herself, oh my God, I do not want to spend $500 on mashed potatoes for people I don't even like that much. I would rather take a vacation. So she and her husband decided to do a destination wedding. They went to Florida. They got married in a hurricane. I think she's pretty happy with that decision about the wedding. The marriage did not last, but I think she was happy that she did not spend all of that money on those potatoes.
Let's go to Jacob now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Jacob.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. What really resonated with me as far as what you were saying was at least with my particular situation, my girlfriend and I have been together for years. It's been mutually decided we're going to get married, but all the architecture that's already in place is a little bit stressful in that, okay, do I pop the question or do we just decide mutually? Okay, we have this event. What do we want that to look like? I would be fine with just going to the courthouse, but I've got plenty of people involved that might feel a little bit slighted with that. And so it really leads me to ask, who's this for? Is this for the couple or is it for all those surrounding in the orbit? And so that can be a little bit stressful and anxious. And it just seems to overcomplicate something that should be very genuine and represent two people becoming one.
So lots of competing interests there, Lindsay, that Jacob is bringing up, and I can kind of feel his stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, wedding planning is really stressful, and I think that he's hitting on something that's really powerful in this conversation that we haven't really talked about yet, which is we call it in scholarship the wedding industrial complex. So kind of like the military industrial complex, except it's about weddings. And what it does is, you know, there are a lot of folks who stand to make a lot of money off of weddings. So we already talked about diamond rings, for example, and De Beers and Tiffany is also profiting off that. But there's a whole wedding industry. I mean, the Knot and Wedding Wire are just small examples of that. But we think about all the catering and the wedding dress makers. I mean, the average cost of a wedding dress in the United States is about $1,600 now, which is unbelievable to me. Flowers, the band, the venue, all those things. And there's a lot of pressure that we see from, you know, popular media, from commercials, from families to sort of do things the right way. But I think it's really important, as the caller is doing here, to ask, like, wait a minute, why are we doing these things? Are these actually because these are things that we really want to do? Or is there pressure, and who does that serve?
Well, is the escalating cost then driven by the market forces of an industry that wants to grow, be very profitable, knows that there will be weddings in the future? Is this really business sense we're talking about?
Well, I think it's absolutely business sense that we're talking about. And, you know, there's also a growing trend for people to do these kind of elaborate vow renewals. So now there's this, you know, I'm a big fan of The Real Housewives, which I can't believe I just said on public radio, but I am. And it's a very common plot point that these women, once they're in their 40s and 50s, you know, they've gone through a few things in their relationships, they'll have these very elaborate vow renewals that are functionally a second wedding. So I think that's another growing market that a lot of those folks who are, you know, supported by the wedding industrial complex, who make a lot of money off of it, are more than happy to see expand.
And I also saw an article yesterday about multiple ceremonies becoming more common, and couples then spending upwards of 100 grand, six figures on weddings, as they look at trying to incorporate different customs, different backgrounds of each person in the wedding.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the downside of the move to personalizing the wedding experience, is that sometimes you're personalizing it for so many people that it becomes, you know, this multi-month affair where you're getting married all over the globe. And actually, my best friend, the one who was struggling with how to address her invitations, her husband is from Africa. So they had actually had three weddings. They got married in the courthouse for citizenship-related reasons. And then they went to South Africa and they got married there with his family, with a few people from the U.S. who were invited to be part of the wedding party. And then she also got married in the Upper Peninsula, where her parents have a cabin. So, well, three weddings.
Looking at LGBTQ weddings, how have they broke form, or do they fit in the mold of tradition?
I've been kind of surprised among my own friends. I've been to quite a few LGBTQ plus weddings in the last 5 or 6 years. And I've been surprised to find that they are often the most traditional of the ones that I go to. They have the most standard pieces and the most sort of standard structure in terms of not necessarily how the guests are seated, but, you know, having one parent walk the kids down the aisle, and having a pretty traditional ceremony, pretty traditional reception, you know, traditional speeches by the father of the bride or the brides, or, you know, whatever it is. It's been really interesting. They've bucked tradition significantly less, in my experience, than the heterosexual weddings I've been to recently.
Millennials are changing love and marriage. We're looking at how wedding customs are evolving with Lindsay Bernhagen as our guide. She directs the Center for Inclusive Teaching and Learning at UW-Stevens Point. Getting your thoughts on wedding customs, they're welcome, 800-642-1234. What about today's weddings no longer feel relevant to you? The vows about being subservient, the garter toss, the trope about the bride being a bridezilla? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. Looking at how couples are breaking marriage traditions, what's changing, what customs seem entrenched in love and marriage. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Wedding Wire, the national average cost for weddings is around $39,000, but that hikes up to an average cost of $50,000 when multiple ceremonies are involved, with some exceeding $100,000. What do you think it will take to change wedding customs? Is there such a thing as a simple ceremony anymore? No frills, no dollar signs. What do you think it would take to get to that point? We're at 800-642-1234. Lindsay Bernhagen stays with us. She directs the Center for Inclusive Teaching and Learning at the UW-Stevens Point. Let's go back to the phones now with Mark joining us from Bloomer. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I am a new, I suppose you use the word convert, to the Quaker tradition. And as I understand, it's about simplicity and about less about the fancy part of weddings and more about the community. And I'm curious what you know, and if you know anything about the Quaker tradition about marriage, and if you could speak about that.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah.
I really don't know much about that, but I would love to learn more.
Mark, do you have any? Oh, I'm sorry. Mark, are you still there?
I'm here.
Yeah. And so as Lindsay fielded back to you, what are some things about the Quaker tradition that speak to you in terms of love and marriage?
As I understand it, I'm not an expert. I'm new. But as I have studied, as I understand it, a couple would come to the meeting, and the meeting is not led by a pastor. We lead ourselves in worship and come before the community of gathered people and say, we wish to be married. And then there's a clearness committee where we get together and we discuss who you are and how you feel you would fit together. And if everybody helps you decide for yourself, if this is still the right move for you, then you come before the community and declare yourselves to each other. And then everybody who's gathered signs the marriage document, and it is then recognized by the community as something that you have done together. And what you choose to do with the state, that's your choice. But it's a simple, beautiful little ceremony where you just commit yourselves to each other.
Mark, thank you so much for describing it to us. And it sounds, Lindsay, like it takes community there in the Quaker tradition to join two people.
I really like that, because I do think it's also a mistake to think that our relationships, our partnerships, our romantic partnerships exist in isolation of our other relationships. I think Most of us have probably had an experience where we've been in a fight, for example, with our significant other, our spouse, and we've relied on, you know, family, friends, whatever it is, to sort of help us process whatever it was that was going on so that we could then return home and we could, you know, work on it with our spouse. I think that support piece is really critical. So I like that. I also really appreciate how it sounds very thoughtful and equitable, the way that Mark was describing the tradition.
Let's bring in Mary Beth now, joining us from Madison. Good morning, Mary Beth.
Good morning.
What's on your mind about weddings?
Well, my son and his wife had a surprise wedding where we were invited to get together. And we assumed, since they had been together for 3 years, it was going to be an engagement announcement, which in essence it was. They were engaged for about 45 seconds. And then they announced they were getting married. That day, in this little pizza parlor / wine bar.
Oh, I love that. What was your reaction, Mary Beth? How did you take...
Shocked. We were absolutely shocked. And I would just say we continued to drink the red wine that had already been poured for us. It was very bare bones. It was there was no wedding dress. There was no tuxedo. There literally were only seven people there, including the minister, who was her best friend, who had just gotten her online ministry certificate. And there were no flowers. They did do silicone rings to get away from the metal bands. And we had basically pizza and salad for the meal.
Great story.
It was very shocking, and we did have to call all of the relatives to announce that he had gotten married that day. So that was rather interesting.
Lots of news there that unfolded very quickly. Mary Beth, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Carrie in Augusta. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I was just making the comment that I think so many of the layers of expectations for weddings come from all the periphery, from the family, from the different family members, and maybe the mothers and fathers and whatever. My son's going to be married in about a year and a half, and I feel like the best gift we can give to him and his Emma is to just get out of the way and let them design a celebration that works for them. And in so doing, they're choosing to be married in our barn, which is a working barn. It's not a wedding barn. They're choosing to have this amazingly diverse group of folks stand up for them. There'll be males and females on both sides of that aisle. And they're going to have taffy apples instead of wedding cake. They're just designing just a celebration that's meaningful to them. But we need to stay out of their way.
Oh, Carrie, thanks so much for the call. And it sounds like they've struck the right balance there between family members and the couple. Lindsay?
Yeah, I think that's really great. And I think it's going to be memorable. Having a wedding like that where the details really mean something to the couple is going to be memorable to the guests, too. And they're not going to regret having spent the money on that. I do want to say one thing about wedding barns that I think is kind of interesting. So Carrie was talking about a working barn, so this is a different situation, but these event barns have become very popular around the state. And as we know that Wisconsin's dairy industry has had a devastating recent history. So there are a lot of vacant barns that are now being used as event barns that were once working barns because it's so popular to have weddings in barns to do sort of the rustic chic kind of thing. But there's been a real issue, I guess, with some of these barns that aren't particularly structurally sound. Mm. So they're just being rented out as these event barns and these big weddings are happening in them. And then there's all sorts of structural and architectural problems with these barns where they're not actually safe places to be. So if you do decide to go for a barn wedding, they could be wonderful. But I would definitely check out the barn beforehand.
Lindsay, let's step back from wedding culture for a moment. When we look at prom culture and you see kids mimicking some wedding-like traditions, these prom fancy dresses and tuxes and limos and dances and after party, how do these traditions fold into where we're headed with wedding culture?
The prom thing is interesting to me. So there's this new, relatively new trend of doing promposals. So a proposal when you ask somebody to go to prom with you, and you know, that's always been a bit of a thing, asking somebody to go to prom with you, but now it's very, very elaborate, like the viral proposal videos that we see that sometimes pop up on Facebook or whatever it is. And to me, it feels a little bit like training for weddings. Let's sort of do a dry run here with how this is all going to go and what you want. And one thing that worries me is that if somebody has a very elaborate prom experience and then that's sort of the bar that they want to get over when they decide to get married and have their actual wedding, well, that's just going to push that the cost and the elaborateness and the glamour of the wedding maybe over the top in a way that it wouldn't necessarily have been otherwise.
Well, as we go ahead.
I just do find the promposals, it's a strange new trend.
Well, as we wrap up here, do you think that traditional weddings are here to stay?
Yeah, I do. I think that they do. I think that people are going to continue to sort of chip away at some of the pieces that are a little unsettling or unfavorable or even gendered. But there is something still really beautiful about gathering your family and friends and making a pronouncement to care for and love the other person and then celebrating that commitment. I've had really, really amazing times at extremely traditional weddings. So I think that there's a lot to be said for that. I hope that people continue to push back, though, on the more materialistic aspects of it and do what they can to personalize the experience.
Lindsay, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Lindsay Bernhagen is director of the Center for Inclusive Teaching and Learning at UW-Stevens Point. Just ahead, we learn how migration could play a critical role in Wisconsin's economic future. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.